That's the number of sources. So in fact, the limitation set of the joint presence makes an unround for the weaker sources. It affects the diffusion. It is a decreased number of sources found. It is there shown that the difference in us, not only voice errors, but also makes it possible to obtain information about the patient at a distance greater than that to which the source can be observed individually.
It is mentioned explicitly in Ryle and Scheuer, but it doesn't look like it's in the...
Well, it's the same year, you see, it's the same time.
Well, that's true, it's the same time.
The point is that this... Oh, it's a public lecture, and therefore you can't go into such detail as you can in this.
Yes, that's true.
But that was May the 6th, and that was March...
a couple of months early. Before, okay.
So, I mean, it was all understood at the time, and then here is the curve for the predicted, the range of predicted curves on the uniform spatial distribution and the observed ones.
So P of D then was an answer to the confusion problem, which you were realizing was a serious one, even as you were analyzing your...
Oh, yes, sure. I mean, that's what it's saying. We and Mills and Bolton had used the counting of sources, but it was paper two. I mean, it was before that actual... Well, of course, they were just kind of the same work, just working up at the same time.
Now, as you were designing the instrument, however, you apparently were not aware that you were going to get so many sources, or else you would have designed it differently. Is that a fair statement?
Of course, we didn't have any idea how many sources we were going to get. I mean, you could extrapolate from the 1C data on the assumption of uniform distribution, which I think is what we did, as far as I remember. But the point is that we didn't only intend to use it on 80 megahertz. If we were going to higher frequencies, then the situation would change. You get a rapid increase in resolving power and a decrease in sensitivity, because receivers at that time fell off fairly dramatically with increasing frequency.
Right.
Perhaps not quite at that frequency, because the galactic background would... not away from the galactic plane, that is true, they were quite a lot worse. And the source flux we knew was falling off anyway. So, I mean, it wasn't, as it were, over-designed for signal to noise if you were going to get higher frequencies. As far as we knew it wasn't.
Anyway. Right. Now, why did you choose to do the low frequency first?
Just because it was easier, fewer dipoles to make. You've got to make a line of dipoles along each level.
So it was not scientific reasons then?
No, we'd done the earlier work at 80 and everything worked there and knew all about the problems. It was obviously going to be more difficult to get a higher frequency. Stability, cable length and everything else.
Right.
Amplifiers, front ends and things.
Now, you mentioned before that once you had the identification of Cygnus A, then it became clear that this was really good stuff, that you could really probe distant parts of the universe.
No, we didn't know that yet. All I said was that if there were other sources like Cygnus, you could see them at distances which are cosmologically interesting. Now, of course, Cygnus-type sources need only represent 1% of the total source property. We didn't know that.
That would be unlikely, perhaps.
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, the actual numbers of stars and galaxies you see in the sky optically is a complete fluke. They come out, whatever they come out as.
Yeah.
You don't know anything, you see, because here you've got a new sky. You don't know how many galactic sources there might be which were invisible optically. So this is just a possibility which had to be demonstrated before you use the possibility of being in the cosmology game, but you didn't know that you were until you had found out what most radio sources were.
So in your grant application for the 2C instrument, for instance, did you mention this cosmological possibility?
I should imagine so, yes.
But you weren't clear that it really was going to be useful for that.
Well, when did we build the instrument, I suppose? It was, well, this was 55, wasn't it?
51 was the identification of Cygnus.
Yes, I'm just wondering when we did in fact build the 2C, 3C aerial. No. Well, anyway, yes, I'm sure it would have been after 1951, I guess, and therefore we certainly would have mentioned the possibility, but only possibility until one knows what proportion of the sources.
And it was only when the hundreds of sources began rolling in that you said, wow, now here we can really...
No, because even that doesn't tell you whether they're galactic or extragalactic or whether they're near or far, you see.
Okay.
It awaited the analysis that the Baikarian lecture did to really know what radio sources are. And that was...
Well, yes, but already here, though, you were talking about cosmology in 55, 3 years earlier.
Well, 1 year earlier, I think, in fact, wasn't it?
No, 58 is the Baikarian
lecture. Perhaps it was. Yes, but the point is that you didn't... Yeah, that's probably fair. The point is that having got a strange result of this sort, and having known of the existence of Cygnus, it is evident that one possible interpretation is that you really are seeing first order cosmology, with most of the sources being things like Cygnus. Then, of course, the whole of the heavens dropped, and everybody said, you know, there must be stars. You said there were stars yourself 3 years ago, and what you're talking about now, you're obviously wrong, whatever you say. And all the difficulties began. So then once, yes, I remember now, one did in fact say, right, we'll go back to square one and prove it step by step.
Right.
Which took 15 years.
And this was indeed...
The Beccarian lecture was the first of these steps,
right.
Which said, step by step, they've got to be mainly extragalactic, and they've got to be mainly powerful extragalactic sources.
Right.
And that's what Jeff Burbage didn't understand this morning.
In 1976.
Goldstein didn't understand it. I spent 5 minutes just before that thing. He said, well, that's very good. Yeah, I've got a copy, I'll read it. So nobody's read it, and the point is nobody read that one either. Because they were both points printed in the Royal Society.
Now, did you have any predilections towards cosmology or anything like that? Or did you just say, well, here's something we can do with the radio data that we have, and if it had been something else, you would have gone into that? Or had you always been interested in cosmology?
No, I don't. I mean, I think it, you know, it's a branch of astronomy like anything else, and obviously... I think, in a sense, the radio astronomer was always an opportunist. He just he went ahead with what seemed like possible.
Yeah.
And if you've got an instrument which can do things, you use it in all the things it'll do,
right.
And you don't try and do things that it won't do.
Right.
And of course, this is a lot of the trouble with some people. They try and use their instruments for the wrong purposes.
Yeah.
And incidentally, it perhaps one of the differences which we've always had here compared with some other places, anyway. We have tended to build instruments on purpose for specific programs. We haven't gone for the all-purpose, all-singing, all-dancing giant paraboloid, which costs the Earth and doesn't do any of the jobs very well. Now, that's slightly unfair, I agree, but it was true in the 1950s of construction of telescopes, that the giant paraboloid was going to be the answer. Now, if money were no object, that was quite a reasonable bet, but money certainly was an object in this country, and... it was therefore much more sensible to spend 6,000 quid doing this and 600,000 quid building a 100-metre dish.
Right. Although I think you'd have to admit that now with the 5 kilometre, that's a pretty general purpose thing now.
It's a very special instrument to produce high resolving power. I mean, it's very special in that context, but I mean, everybody's trying to build high resolving power telescopes.
But it can map. It can't just do one survey and then you close shop with it, such as with the 2C and 3C aerial.
But this was a thing which wasn't designed to look at radio galaxies. It was designed to produce high resolving power. It wasn't designed to think which could do high resolving power or plot Sputniks or measure the brightness of the retrograde background. You know, that's sort of the generalisation I feel. We've always reckoned that you can build far cheaper a range of instruments to tackle different fields than one instrument that would do them all.
Right.
Because it's always a compromise. Engineering is always a compromise. And you end up with building a vastly expensive instrument which doesn't in general do any of them quite as well as a specialist instrument of a fraction of the price. Yeah. Oh, that's an irrelevant thing for the moment.
No, that's not irrelevant at all. Did you have any idea, I can't refrain from asking you, the hornet's nest that you would be getting into when you got into the cosmology game?
No, I mean, that was a considerable shock, actually, because, of course, the trouble with cosmology up to then, it had been a playground of mathematicians, is space curved this way or that way, and all these things. It was nothing to do with the real world very much, and observations had never, and apparently would never, make any effect on it. It was a game which mathematicians could play, safe from all possible attack. And the development of the steady-state model was a breakthrough, an important breakthrough, in that here was something which made specific predictions in a wide range of not necessarily thought of possible measurements. It said that the universe was in a state which would remain the same through time as well as space. And that was a completely general general thing which would allow one, in any future observation, to test it. Now, here straight away was an observation which, as soon as you know that you've got sequences, could be applied, because straight away it predicts something quite definite. As soon as you know you can detect sources at large redshifts large enough for things to happen on other cosmologies, then you can detect a difference.
Right.
Now, in fact, of course, the difference we found was considered to be larger than the various geometrical models, which none of which differ very much from the steady state with ordinary sort of sources. And it implied, in fact, that one, of course, had to have source evolution as well at a fairly dramatic rate, which meant that it was this sort of thing you were going to be investigating rather than the subtle differences from space curvature. So, I mean, I think when we made this fairly tentative proposal here, it was remarkable what an absolute storm it provoked. Well, of course, it wasn't helped by the fact that the press got hold of the story and, you know, this thing.
I've heard about this headline at the RAS. Was it Cambridge professor says world is flat or something? Oh, no, that was Sputnik. At the same time.
Well, it was the same sort of thing, you know. Right. You see, God with the radio telescope, it was very sickening. But, you know, one felt that having put forward a cosmological model which was unique in allowing itself to be tested,
right. They
should have at least had the grace to admit that, you know, okay, here was an interesting test which they would have to look at carefully rather than the explosion which occurred. Well, anyway, when that did happen, of course, then they said, right, we won't say another word till we've proved things step by step by step, and the Baikerian lecture was the first of these steps.
And the 3C survey, I suppose, was...
The 3C survey, that followed straight after, we just changed the frequency in this four-element machine. And that 3C survey was, by and large, not much different from VCR. There were some things, some extended sources missing, which were found with, you see, the 3CR was in fact, as you probably know, based on the first non-synthesis observations with the 4C telescope.
Right.
And it included pencil beam measurements as well as interferometer ones to get over the problem of the possibility of being an important population of extended sources.
It seems to me, in trying to analyze the whole 2C, Mills, Ryle, and everything else, controversy, Hoyle, that there was a great confusion of issues involved here, that you had one instrumental technique versus another. You had one cosmology versus another. You had whether P of D was valid. You had the influence of extended sources, how much that might be changing things. And that people were talking at cross purposes often. Do you agree with that, or do you think that the issue was very clear?
No, it wasn't all that clear. I mean, obviously, if there were a significant number of extended sources, and at the 3C stage, before 3CR, before the 4C era was built, the sensitivity for extended sources was quite a lot less. On the other hand, and this in fact turns out to have been quite important, the Mills Cross observations undoubtedly included sources which were in fact fluctuations of galactic background and shouldn't have been counted as sources at all, and that can have an equal effect in the opposite direction, which in fact was rather more serious, I think. So that was one thing, which was a direct, as you say, a direct outcome of the different technologies which had been invented. As of Sun, phase switched, all the rest of it, had built this technique to make this clear distinction between what was galactic background and what was source. Well, obviously the boundary here is right. Marginal. There are structures which get finer and finer in the galaxy and get interested in how they got weak enough by the time they got so fine that there's no confusion with the real sources. So that was certainly one difficulty. I think the side lobes of the Mills Cross were also more of a problem than they realised at the beginning. Our over-analysis of 2C was obviously a disastrous fault, but the P of D did try and avoid that. But that, in a way, wasn't so serious. Obviously, here was something that got to be cleared up, the difference in extra state observations. It was really the sort of fury of the steady-state cosmologists in not wanting to believe proof. Well, I know, it's fair enough. It was that some years, and we obviously wanted to explore all possibilities. And then this game on the one hand, step-by-step confirmation of what we thought to be there was in fact there, and on the other hand, investigating each crazy let out which the steady state model was distorted to.
Right. I was talking with Paul Scott, and He has two papers, and I don't think you're co-authors. One answering Shyama's.
That's right.
And one answering Hanbury Brown.
It went on and on and on. And I mean, it got more and more. I mean, by the end, the steady-state model was so ridiculous, it was more complicated than an evolutionary model.
Well,
than special
it
things
had lost its original
beauty. Yes, I mean, there was no point in it anymore, it seemed to me. It hadn't done.
Now, you said a while ago that beginning this step-by-step approach, that just recently, I think you implied that you've more or less come to your goal of really establishing the result, and I'm not sure exactly which observation you think is finally done.
No, not recently. I'm talking about the stage when we'd done that,
the Beccarian lecture,
which meant that any explanation in terms of little local irregularities had to extend to about z=1, and we had to be bang in the centre of it, so about 1% of the volume that you allow yourself,
right.
Which you can't disprove, but it's no longer a sensible cosmology, because
right.
You are in a special place then. And that had to be answered. I think Shaw wrote
it's
that.
It's not a good post-Copernican cosmology.
No, exactly. And I think it was Peter Shaw wrote a paper which went into all that and showed how stupid it was. Then there was, of course, tidying up the log n log s story. Another thing, of course, which went wrong was everybody always said that the discrepancy between Ewer and the predicted 1.5 is so small that I can cover it by doing this and this, adding a few extended sources. But of course, it was never 1.5. It's more like 1.3 over the relevant range, if what one's talking about has any sense. I'm objecting to something about the luminosity of the source. You know what distances you're talking about, and that there's a considerable drop-off, any model, steady state included, and the discrepancy was therefore considerably worse than what. And I think Bernie has never understood that.
The steady state really, because
it doesn't give a 1.5. No, it doesn't give 1.5. So it is already with powers of the order which we must be having. There are considerable spectral.
Right.
Flux diminutions. Right. So it's going down a lot faster than Euclidean.
Yeah.
It is curling off quite rapidly over this flux range.
Right.
And therefore, it isn't discrepancy between that line and that line, discrepancy between that line and this line.
Right.
And that was a quite a big difference, which I think Mills could never appreciate, or certainly in those days.
Didn't the bandwidth also, doesn't that also make the slope less? I'm thinking wrong. The fact that the bandwidth, as you go to higher redshifts,
That's all part of it. It's the flux, it's the energy per unit bandwidth
right.
at the receiver which you're measuring,
right.
and that's part of this
yeah,
curve.
Right.
That's right. But there's several other things which come in as well. The volume of space represented by two limits of redshift and things.
What do you think? Would you say that this sort of became resolved?
Then of course 4C came along, which of course went a lot further and showed. Same sort of thing, and that had a pencil beam thing associated with it to look for extended sources. And then finally, there was a PFD on that, which Tony Hughes did, which did the same thing. And then finally, there was this very small area of sky, which Anne Neville and I did at the North Pole, which was done as a part, it was trying out the supersynthesis principle, which we used bits of the 4C aerial as a variable spacing thing, and mapped this little bit of area around the North Pole in an absolutely unambiguous, unarguable way. Because here was a pencil beam method, you see. Good old, proper method, not an indirect method, a pencil beam method, which would draw on a map and see things on it, without any argument. And it then became very hard for people to say, they're all blending, because the resolving power is very high indeed. And, 25 beamlets per source, you were still,
So that was 65, I think, or so, that North Polar survey, is that right?
Oh, no, it's more then, because the one I was built was by 62, 63, 64. It must have been 61, wasn't it?
I don't have any publications after 60 here.
Oh, I see, yes. And that I would have said was probably 61.
So Ryle and Neville was 62, right. So it was really then, you would say, 7 years before this got resolved from the time of the first presentation of the 2C survey.
Well, I mean, I think after there's this PFD on the 4C survey data, which...
That's Hewish in 61.
That's right, yes. Which was more or less the same time as the, as we thought, definitive paper on all this, Clark and myself, which was talking about the PFD as well again, and all this stuff again about isotropy.
This is Ryland Clark, which year?
61 or 61. So, January. Doing this sort of thing, which was done this is what the luminosity function as derived from the Kirin. It's got to go down at least that much or more. If you take the identified sample of sources, it's like that. So it's
much deeper.
Which is it's the difference between that observed and these theoretical ones, which are talking about, not that on a straight line, which you can draw through there or something.
Right, this is figure 6 of the Ryland Clark paper, right. I must admit, I'll have to look at that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that coupled with this one here, which actually took it a bit further with more sky and more everything else, and now started putting limits in the cutoff here.
In the Hewish paper, yeah.
Yes. This is not this is saying specifically that as well as having this high initial slope, it's got to converge rapidly from the V of D method. Now, the North Pole survey was important in confirming that by a method which nobody could not understand. It was just, it's rather a nice map.
I've seen that. I don't have it.
So that also was that's a little later. And then, of course, fairly soon after that, 2 years after that, the first IC survey came along to sort of pinch the whole thing. But I mean, about that time, 62, 63, I suppose, I gave a final account of this, I think, to the RES meeting, and I said that as far as I was concerned, was that this is a voyage you've been taking for the last 10 years or so, and it had been a stormy one, but it seemed to me that it got as far as it could get.
I see.
And by and large, it hasn't, of course, changed very much since then.
You've brought up aperture synthesis, which, of course, I want to talk about. Can you tell me when you first began thinking about the possibilities of aperture synthesis and its various types?
Well, that goes back a very long time, actually. Of course, the early work on the sun to get the distribution of the quiet sun. I mean, having done this work on the sunspots, which is, in a sense, much easier because it's so strong. We then set about this program, first of all with Harold Stanier, later with Ken Mitch and Patrick Brown,
right.
A series of papers in which we attempted to discover the brightness distribution across the sun at different wavelengths as a means of getting the temperature distribution in the corona, which of course was interesting back to what I was talking about just now, where the energy is coming from. And it was, I think, recognised that it was free emission from the quiet sun, if not the other one, and therefore it told you an important thing about the actual physical situation at various heights in the corona.
And there was a controversy about limb brightening and so forth.
That's right, yes. Well, yes, you had a lot of resolving power for that, and this did in fact show up. But at that time, the measurements we made did not have phase stability, because of the difficulties. I mean, we were quite big distances, at that time it was quite high frequencies, and the cabling and everything wasn't good enough, nor indeed was the location of the telescopes, the way we had to move them. And therefore, which is perfectly legitimate for the quiet sun, we assumed symmetry of the source.
Right.
Initially, it was just east-west distributions. Subsequently, we extended this to all around, and we, in fact, used the same technique which is used in synthesis. We observed at different hour angles. We were limited at that time by the piece of land we had, which you couldn't get much aperture north-south anyway. But we used observations at different hour angles to give us resolution in declination, and went one stage further and assumed initially that... Sorry, the first stage, we just assumed it had circular symmetry.
Right.
Clearly, you might have polar equatorial asymmetry, so we then did these experiments with north-south resolution by observing off the meridian, but they still assumed east-west symmetry, which meant that you didn't have to have, well, east-west and north-south symmetry, I mean, you don't have to have a phase in either method. And I suspect the relationship between what an interferometer measures and the Fourier transform of the brightness of the sky was realized by various people. I think the Australians...
I think the MacReady...
MacReady, Pawsey, Payne, Scott
right,
paper...
First time it is mentioned in print.
Said that, yes. which I don't know if they actually used that at that time at all. I can't recall anything. But anyway, Harold Stanier was the first, I think, to actually apply it.
With variable spacing
to actually get the distribution. And that sort of work went on, but also we built an instrument aimed at measuring an arbitrary sky, not just say, an isolated sun in zero brightness background, but to actually look at an arbitrary piece of sky by using a long east-west thin array like that, and an element which we moved north-south from it.
Right, what we call a T-aerial now.
That's right, yes. And that was done by John Blythe.
Right.
And that was the first, I think, synthesis in the sense that it was synthesizing a true telescope aperture without any preconceived knowledge of the sources that might lie in it. You know, it was a proper mapping instrument. And that had whatever it is, 38 spaces or something, but it was really quite a big instrument. It was used at 38 megahertz for the phase problem, and the surveying problem was easy. You could have errors of 6 inches in the positioning of the earth, it didn't matter much. And it did produce, you know, whatever it was, a two and a half degree beam or something, which was, you know, we felt quite proud of at the time, because it was, with a few little bits of string, you had made this huge great telescope,
which
was quite a nice map, in fact. So the analysis of this was very tedious. In fact, all through the history of synthesis, we've been just about on the limit of what computers can do. If they'd come along a few years later, we would have been limited by them rather than what we thought we could do engineering wise. But that was the beginning of a proper synthesis, and that it was somewhat related to the points in the phase switch paper showing that you could fill apertures with far less hardware than you would have thought necessary. That paper, it had an array which, in a one-dimensional case, it had bits like that one end, and then something like that, which did, in fact, together fill up
along
that.
You had all the spacings there.
Yes. Now, that was, of course, part of the same story. It was showing that you could build telescope you hadn't actually got.
Right.
And this was taking it. It wasn't quite the same, but it was related to it. But of course, in this case, the analysis was done automatically. By the sky going around. In this case, you had to add them up in a computer, and we'll do a Fourier transform in a computer.
Were you aware at all of the work that ARSOC and I think someone else in France was doing at this time on optimum arrays and sort of thing?
I didn't think he'd done it in 1952.
Well, not 52, no.
No, this is 52, you see.
This is back in, that's true. That's back in.
And that's 54, and I think ARSAC was after that.
He was 55 or something.
Yes,
you're right.
Yes.
Now, I wanted to ask, I've heard from other people that Radcliffe's lectures on Fourier theory were rather influential. Was this true with you also?
Well, obviously they were. I think I'm not very good at mathematics, and the full import didn't hit me. But I'm very good at visualizing what things are physically, and I saw no difficulty in making a thing like that which was equivalent to a big instrument. The precise procedure whereby you mathematically treated the data was a Fourier transform, and I was prepared to see that. But I could have done it some other way without understanding it. But he is sure. I mean, he clearly had a profound influence on Harold Stanier, for example. Mm-hmm. I think. The whole concept of how you do these things was obviously very important.
And
a Fourier transform is a nice technique for coping with the data. But I had always thought of this as a way of filling up the aperture, taking space and saying that if I had the full aperture, it would have had these distributions of spacings present.
Right.
And this is, I thought much more of the air. And then that's why always in the early lectures I used to say how we can build a telescope, rather than saying this thing measures one term of the Fourier transform, so therefore it's evident that if I do a Fourier inversion, this I would get the sky out. But that's just the way I brought out that. Very, very mathematically trained.
Now, can you tell me when the idea of the Earth rotation came to you?
That was about the same time, as a matter of fact.
In the early 50s.
It's very interesting that it was so early. 54, I think.
So we're looking at a notebook called Future Programs, Etc.
Let me find this actually.
When does this notebook date from? Well, here.
Oh, that's 58. 57. Oh, this may be Vol 2. I'm not sure. I think this is Vol 2. This is designing the core scenario. So, origin of active background radiation. It's getting sort of rare galactic. That's the wrong book.
So, we're looking at, let's see, may I have a copy of this?
Yes, sure.
Yes, thank you. This is the Nobel Prize lecture, and the quote is from June 8th, 54. And it says, possible research student and other projects. And it has North Polar Survey at 81 megahertz. Effective resolving power area, about 1 million square feet. And then June 54, it says to try to do a North Polar survey in all directions where 180 degrees rotation is available. It might be possible by doing directing aerials in successively different directions, i.e. observation not on meridian. So indeed, fully 8 years before it was carried out, or so, you were discussing this possibility.
Yes, the actual paper goes into the notebook goes into the actual design of it. We're going to do it with a Wurzburg, actually, on east-west rail track.
We had realized that a thing would have difficulty in some declinations in filling all the azimuths you need. The actual decision not to, well, the point is that we were faced at that time with let's see, where were we? Yes, the question was whether we were going to get the Lordsbridge site. This was still on the old, small site over a couple of fields away over here,
Grange Road.
And that was running out of room. We could have got this instrument on it, just, because we would have used it on probably 20 megahertz or thereabouts, and it would have been quite a powerful instrument. The fact that we had the availability of the much bigger area at Lord's Bridge allowed us to consider other instruments, and coupled with the difficulty we have before see of doing the much more sophisticated two-dimensional Fourier inversion, which this would have involved, in fact, there wasn't a computer which would have done it. You see, even in 1960, when did we say we did the North Pole survey?
62,
I think it
published.
Was. Yes, even that, to put that together, took, I think, 36 hours of the university computer's time. And this was, well, it was one of the biggest computers in the world at the time, ETSAC 2. And that was, well, it was whatever it was, 8 years after we were talking about this instrument. And therefore, I think I'm sure quite rightly, looking back on it, we decided to keep to one-dimensional things, and the new telescopes were built at Lord's Bridge, which were the 4C aerial and the big 38 megacycle array, were both built on this one-dimensional principle.
Right. We haven't explicitly talked about Lord's Bridge. That was once again probably is 1C to 2C, and then 2C to Lord's Bridge.
No, 3C was done with the 2C area, you see.
Right.
3C was done with that. 3CR was simply tidying it up, having got this big instrument built, but not yet working as a synthesis instrument.
So 4C was the first major thing done at Lord's Bridge. Is that correct?
Well, we observed the sky again with this instrument, not as a synthesis instrument, which made 3CR. 4C was the first big survey done with a proper, a large synthesis telescope, yes.
And it was the first major thing done at Lord's Bridge?
Yes, well, there were two of them, actually. There was the 4C survey and a thing just like this, and it was that way around, but much bigger. This was a kilometre or so, and produced the 38 megacycle survey, Carmen Costain. John Borden.
Right. Yeah, I've talked to them about that. And the Mueller thing was once again a question of financing, where in this case the government apparently couldn't come through.
Well, the government was not able to buy land. The university has to acquire land. It will provide scientific equipment.
I see.
So we were stuck until we could get some funds to get a piece of land and build the basic laboratory equipment, bring electricity to it and all these things. And that's where the Mueller money was very important.
I see. Just a couple more questions. I made a note here. In the 2C survey paper in 1955, you mentioned that 100 of the 2,000 sources agree with NGC IC objects. And of course, most of those turn out not to be right. But what I wanted to ask you is, did you find that very discouraging, that still, with all these sources, there were very few even possible optical identifications?
Well, I don't think it was discouraging. I mean, in a sense, it would have been discouraging if these are things we knew all about. You see, I mean, I think that nowadays one sees that optical information on radio sources is terribly important. But, I mean, the exciting thing at that time was to hear something quite different.
Yeah. So it just made it more tantalizing, you're saying.
Well, sure. I mean, the fact they were unidentified, when, of course, you knew they were, in fact, the very powerful source of explanation for the prior identification, right, was clear. But equally, it was that much more exciting.
Yeah. Okay. And now getting into the late 50s, you did a project, which I'm not quite sure what the purpose of it was. It was Elsmore, Ryle, and Leslie, 59, in which you had a system of calibration sources at different declinations, 64 radio sources at 179 megahertz. And I wanted to ask what the purpose of that was.
Oh, this is just a first astrometric survey, I think, wasn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I just looked at the abstract, and it said that they were for reference purposes. That was the word.
That's right. Well, you see, they were to present all over the sky sources which you could calibrate other instruments with.
I see.
And the technique was simply that it was done with the 4C telescope, the east-west. It's like that.
Right.
It's on rails. And, for example, if that's on the central position, then of course you've got this high-resolution interferometer, which can fix your positions to whatever it was, 10 seconds of arc or something, the strong sources. Rather than doing a complete synthesis of huge areas of the sky, we did a quick program in which you covered all the sources every night, virtually, at each of a number of facings along here.
Right.
Now, looking along that axis, you've therefore got a parabola, a centigrade, which you're going to move along like there. And what you're doing is measuring the phase difference between the signals you receive from a given source at transit in these different positions.
Right.
And therefore, that allows you to get the declination with the resolution appropriate to a 1,000-foot aperture.
I see.
And the point, observationally, was that if you now stick the telescope in that position and in one 24-hour period observe all these 64 sources, I don't think you could actually do it as fast as that. I think we had to do it in several nights. But the point is that with one, over a short period of time, you observe all those sources, then move to another position, do it all over again, the instrument effects all disappear. By and large, the phase of the system and even the infrequency things disappear, and you've got a coherent system of objects all tied to the same positional astrometric system.
I see.
And so it was just simply to get 64 sources whose positions were really rather accurately known.
And so your recent interest in astrometry is really nothing new either.
Oh yes. No, I mean obviously astrometry always was important because the identification always clearly entirely dominated by the poor positional accuracy you get. If you've got a series of sources around the sky, which you measure by an independent means very accurately, then if you come to doing a survey, and the strip surveys are of course in strips anyway, if you've got a source in each of those strips to calibrate it with, you're all right.
Right.
You can tie that whole strip down mm-hmm. in absolute coordinates, absolute measured by this E64 sources.
And so that was used for the 4C survey.
Oh, yes. Mm.
Well, one final question that I'm very interested in, and that is, it seems to me that the Cambridge group has been remarkably successful in the people that have been trained here and gone all over the world as well as stayed here later on. And I'm wondering how you're able to pick people, usually just pick them as after they finish 3 years of undergraduate, or is it something that happens here? What are your views on that?
I hope it's a bit of both. I mean, obviously, there's some positive feedback in these situations. Directly one group starts to get some nice results, the best people tend to want to come here, and right. So you probably get a better selection of people that
that apply to CUM, so you can use a tighter selection procedure.
Right.
But, well, I don't know. Perhaps we train them better.
Well, that's certainly true. You have a certain definite philosophy in training, which you were telling me about at lunch, namely that they should get their hands dirty and actually see what an aerial is like. But in the selection process, I was going to say, in the selection process, I was wondering what it was that you looked for particularly.
I think I'm never very happy about selecting people. I never know whether we've made the right choice for a year, which I suppose is what everybody finds. I think we've probably put more emphasis on the guy's outlook on life compared with his academic record than some places do. We're interested in knowing whether he goes climbing or gliding or something rather than play chess. Now that's not fair because playing chess is quite good for theoretical people. But I mean, I think being a radio astronomer, certainly in the early days, and not quite so much now, but certainly isn't just a question of knowing your physics well. You've got to have some enthusiasm and dedication, because it's awful depressing work sometimes, and you've got to be able to survive these periods.
So there's much more than, like you say, the formal curriculum vitae that you're interested in.
Anyway, applicants from America, we never understand all these things. They write on those.
Well, thank you very much.
So that ends the interview with Martin Ryle on 19th August 76.